From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It's one of the best-known naturalistic gardens anywhere, and yet it's perched in the most unnatural spot imaginable, 30 feet high above New York City traffic on an abandoned, elevated railway line. The High Line on Manhattan's West Side is celebrating the 15th anniversary of the opening of its first section, years that have been filled with expert lessons on gardening in this looser, nature-inspired style. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Walcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Today's guest is Richard Hayden, the Highline Senior Director of Horticulture. His team of 10 horticulturists manages the naturalistic gardens originally designed by Piet Oudolph of the Netherlands, spanning portions of the 1.5-mile beloved Highline Park that welcomes about 7 million visitors a year. Hello, Richard. So good to talk to you again.
Hi there, Margaret. So happy to be with you.
Yeah. So happy anniversary, birthday, whatever we want to call it, to you and
Thank
the team.
You.
And it was
Thank
fun
you.
Kind of meeting some of you, at least virtually, to do a recent New York Times garden column together, which got a great response, which made me happy. So briefly, I think for people who are listening from all over the place who may not have visited, you know, kind of tell us the lay of the non-land over there. I mean, it is a nutty setup when you think about it.
When you think about it all together, the fact that it happened at all is sometimes a miracle. So, of course, it was an unused elevated railway on the west side of Manhattan. And over the course of the 20 years that the trains weren't running, seeds had drifted in and birds had probably dropped a few things off and soil had sort of gotten created. And so this landscape had occurred. And when the time came to consider what to do with it in the early and the late 90s, the idea that it could become a garden, because people were up here looking at it in its wild state, and there were some amazing photographs taken by Joel Sternfeld of its wild state, that it became this idea that it could be a garden. And Piet Oudolph was hired, and field operations and Diller Scofidio and Renfro did some great designs. And here we are 15 years later. And it is, I think, one of the most important public gardens of the 21st century, because it changed the way we think about how we garden.
Yeah.
You know, it's the four-season garden. As Piet says, a plant isn't worth growing unless it looks good dead. And so, and it's true. It's so beautiful here in the fall and in the winter. But it's three-dimensional garden chess that he plays, because each zone is slightly different, and it gives you this emotionally evocative journey as you go through you go from woodlands to grasslands and different combinations and complexities. And of course, all that complexity leads to biodiversity. We have many bees and birds and other animals that visit. So it's just a really wonderful respite from the city.
And the thing that when we did the Time story that I just found, when you first said it to me, and I just can't get over the idea of it, you have your soil depth up there and these beds that were built for this on this elevated, you know, railway. The soil is never more than 18 inches deep. I mean, it's like raised beds on a raised railroad platform.
Yeah, you're right. It's primarily 18 inches. There's a couple spots where we've got some raised planters that we kind of mound up
right.
and maybe get to 30 inches or so. And I have to tell you, when I first started, which was about a little over 2.5 years ago, and I was seeing these 30-foot-tall birch trees and oak trees and all these big trees growing in 18 inches of soil. It literally kept me up at night. Every time the wind would blow,
I would have a panic attack.
Yes.
At the thought of it. Exactly.
And then I did some hiking in Northwest Connecticut on the Appalachian Trail, and there had been a windstorm and these mature trees had blown over, and lo and behold, 18 inches of roots, because all of the glacial rock, the forest was literally growing in 18 inches of soil. And I thought, you know what? Mother Nature's figured this out. I don't have to worry so much.
Okay. So you got started sleeping. Okay, good.
Yes, exactly.
But it is, it's really quite a feat. And it's great that it was inspired by that sort of self-sown madness that had happened in this abandoned space, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Obviously with an artistic eye. And
yeah,
the problem with 18 inches is that it doesn't leap, because there can be warm air on top and warm air underneath, and cold air on top and cold air underneath. So we don't have a lot of cushion.
No.
So during heat waves, for instance, we have to be very careful to keep things with the right moisture levels. And then in the winter, sometimes we do lose a few things if we have a wet, you know, cold snap or something.
Right.
So
right.
It does make challenges for that way.
So Pete designed it in a naturalistic style, and he's kind of the leader of that movement. But it doesn't mean that it's all native. And it also doesn't mean, naturalistic doesn't mean like hands off, let it do its thing, whatever happens, happens. It is a design. So let's
Correct.
Talk a little bit about that, you know.
Right. So it is about 50% native. We did a wonderful hort celebration last year where we honored New York City native plants, and we found out we had 160 species that were native or known to be native to New York City out of the 500 or so species that we have. And they weren't chosen because they were native. They were chosen because they're just really good, resilient plants. So I was happy to kind of do that discovery. And Pete is very much about, you know, gardens are for people. And so natives are great, but sometimes there are bloom periods where the natives really aren't filling the niche, or maybe they don't have enough winter structure. Or so he's happy to combine things as long as they are well-behaved.
Mm.
And we have a few that have not been so well-behaved. So it's a learning curve.
Don't we all, Richard? Don't we all have a few of those?
Well, to be a successful plant on the High Line, you have to have a certain amount of resilience, a certain amount of aggression, you know? And so a lot of what we do is manage those. We have a grass, Korean feather grass, that was planted in one area. And I noticed in some photographs, in about 3 years after it was planted, it had been 20% of the mix. And three years later, it was 80% of the mix, because it's just such a virulent reseeder. So that's one of the things we have to do, is we have to manage those things that want to be too successful so they don't swallow their neighbors. Keep the balance.
Well, and so some of the tactics that he suggested in the initial design, and that you and your team kind of uphold and so forth, to be naturalistic. I mean, for instance, there was one that really you guys talked to me about during the Times Story interview, which, of course, it didn't really occur to me. I wouldn't have noticed it consciously, but there it is, and it's so obvious now that you have said it aloud to me. When you have the garden on both sides of a path, that these drifts of plants that are on the one side also should sometimes be on the other side, so that it looks as if the path was added through a natural area, as opposed to like this sort of continuity, as opposed to these are two separate gardens and here is my path, and you know,
right,
more man-made, and just of these types of hints like that. Any others like that that you think about, like well, let's talk about the drifts maybe, because that's an important aspect of his types of designs and naturalistic.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, it would be so easy to get these super complex gardens with, you know, lots of plants appearing all next to each other. But when you're using nature as a model, nature has a tendency to not, I mean, it can be a very thick planting, but often it's a repetition of a series of species. So that's what Pete has kind of replicated. He'll choose, you know, what he calls his major kind of accent plants. And then the Highline Garden is actually what he would consider a matrix garden. So it's a planting of kind of a ground crown cover layer, often flowering. So you can have things like autumn moorgrass or catmint and other things that will just kind of give you a basis and a ground cover. And that's the sort of thing that you'll see often drifting on both sides of the path. And then into that are the larger perennials that occur in threes and fives and sevens and always odd numbers for some reason, but it does always looks better. But he keeps it simple by keeping the drifts kind of large. It becomes a little bit more legible. And then many of the new gardens that he does are actually block planting, where it's just series of blocks, obviously never a geometric shape, more of a tear shape or, you know, some sort of a more natural shape. But he does that quite frequently with his newer gardens because it's easier to take care of. You know what's supposed to be where, you know what's gotten out of balance.
I see.
But here at the Highline, we're a little bit more complex. So we're constantly managing the dynamics of any one species. And some things, they don't succeed. You know, we had a couple of plants very much into heleniums, and I'm forgetting common names, but
sneezeweed,
right? Yes. And they just never took. And of course, Pete doesn't use a lot of red, and it's kind of a burgundy red, the one that he was suggesting here.
Yeah.
I think it was Morheim Beauty. And we had to look for other things because it just was never happy.
Yeah. So he kind of, in his original planting designs for the various garden areas at the Highlands, he kind of narrows down, I mean, these are smaller spaces than nature, but he narrows down the number of key plants that will be in, and he uses large numbers of each one in these drifts and these naturalistically shaped drifts. So, because you don't want it to just be a zillion polka dots all over the place of chaos. I mean,
right.
That's not going to read, is it?
No.
And
it's just interesting. We're having this conversation, and I was just this morning laying out a Pete Audoff design. We have a new plaza that's going in at street level at 18th Street. That'll be the newest section of the High Line to open in September. And it's the first time I've laid out a Pete design, and we were looking at the plans. And it really is, in this particular plan, big drifts of different kinds of grasses. And then there's geraniums coming in here and geums over here and, you know, agastakis over here. And you get a better sense of really what he's doing. This is the first time I've ever done it, but it's really exciting to kind of lay the garden out, and you get a sense of really how his mind kind of works. You see the structure behind what he's trying to do.
I guess it was last year, maybe he had a book come out. It's kind of about his career, his projects, and there were a lot of his designs in it, you know, as part of the art in the book, not just photographs. And you can see that there too. You can, you know, kind of see these shapes and the plants that are specified to go in each one and so forth. So, yeah.
Right.
You know, the other thing I find interesting about the drifts is it pleases our eye and it works in this style, you know, to do it that way. But in nature, you know, if you had just onesies of a million different things, the animals, especially the insects who are dependent on these plants, couldn't find them and couldn't utilize them in the same way. So the drifts also serve a purpose. Do you know what I mean? In nature, in the natural world.
Absolutely.
These plant communities are not just a million different kinds of plants all crunched together. They're a few key plants and in larger numbers.
And in more of the grassland plantings, for instance, he's relying on certain plants to have the structure to hold other plants up, which is what, of course, happens in their natural environments as well.
Yeah, the meadows and prairies are really grasslands. You know,
right.
They're, no. So I'm told by a lot of people, you know, who have tried to or who have gone more naturalistic in some area of their gardens, you know, maybe made a small meadow or whatever. You know, I hear, well, but it keeps changing. It doesn't look like the original plan. It's not how I imagined it. It doesn't look like the picture in the book, you know, when they bought it from a catalog, they bought the seed or the plugs or whatever. And you know, so that's sort of that oops, hello succession, you know, natural succession, you know, the way things go in nature. And so let's talk a little bit about that, because this is something that the Highline 15 years on, or any naturalistic garden even 5 years on, doesn't look exactly like the plan, even if it was a Pete plan, you know.
Correct. And Pete always says it's never, a garden's never done. And it is an evolution, and the garden will tell you what it wants to become. And so, when we are the stewards of these naturalistic landscapes, we're interrupting the succession, right? That succession being, the natural world is moving from a grassland to a mature forest, and that's generally the course of the evolution of planting. And so we get to step in and say, we want to keep it as a grassland, and so we need to make these interventions. We need to make substitutions for the plants that aren't working. We need to edit out the ones, the thugs, if you will, that get too happy. We get to be completely surprised by the serendipity of something seeding in, or the combination that you really weren't certain of, but it's kind of rearranged itself in the way that some of the things have seeded. So it's kind of being awake to how the garden wants to mature, and hopefully having a somewhat light touch on making sure that you get something that's pleasing and you're making the right combinations kind of be successful.
But it is a lot of editing. I mean, it's not just stepping back and going, okay, that's done, it's been planted, all finished, on to the next project. It's not that at all.
No, and some things literally are meant to be kind of fillers in an early planting. And then once the grasses get established, they will, want to become 80% of your meadow. And so you have to maybe have strategies for removing a few. Some of the taller grasses, the giant bluestem?
Little bluestem, and I don't know what you call the big one, but yeah.
Big bluestem.
Big bluestem.
Which left to its own devices was at one point crowding out the pathway. Yeah. And so we have to go in and say, you know what, you're great. We need you in the back. We need you a little bit more as a punctuation rather than as a kind of solid wall. And so that's where a lot of the editing comes in.
Yeah, because you were just saying the different plants and how they, they almost have like a life cycle, certain plants in these designs, and some are almost used as like nurse crops, what you might call as nurse crops in the beginning to fill space with something other than weeds that might come up from the soil. So some of your biennials and so forth, they're not going to last five or 10 years later. They're not going to be there because, as you point out, the grasses and other things will have filled in, and those things that are dependent on self-sowing aren't going to have as many opportunities to reach bare soil anymore. And their life cycle will be over from those original plants. So, your black-eyed Susans or whatever that you were like, oh, look, there are so many of those. They look so pretty. Well, that may not happen in year 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 anymore.
Yeah. This morning I was placing Oriental poppy, which we don't have on the Highland. It was one of the original plants that were spec'd, but it's one of those early interesting flower plants to come up between the small grasses for the first 2 or 3 years.
Right.
And then I think it kind of, they're not terribly long lived in my experience anyway. So it's just one of those, let's create some interest. We had the same with, is it foxtail lily? The
Aramurus?
Aramurus, yes. Uh-huh. The same thing. Uh-huh. Really successful, a wonderful highline plant in the first 5 years, but now it's been kind of crowded out by grasses, and we try to get it established again, and it's a tricky one. It's one of those so used to having expert drainage and kind of hot, dry places. So, So you make sacrifices. You say, well, that was great in the beginning, and now we'll move on to let the garden have some other aspect that's going to shine.
Right. So another form of editing, a lot of people have heard of the Chelsea chop, timed and named for the Chelsea Flower Show in England, because in late May, certain kinds of perennials are cut back partway. And doing that, they're sort of bushier, and they start blooming a little later, but they're fuller and so forth. So you kind of take it to an extreme up there. You guys have got Chelsea chops going on, and so just tell me a little bit about that method of kind of editing and the pictures.
Well, it I think it primarily comes from the aspect, like, we have so many plants, and the gardens are so full, we don't have the ability to stake anything,
right?
So asters in the tall grass prairie, like Chelsea grasslands will do okay with just one chop, where we'll, you know, hit them pretty much in late May, early June, right around the Chelsea flower show. But we have, I think it's Aster October skies that are peppered throughout the Gansevoort woodlands of the birch woodlands down here at the south end of the park. And those require, because they're in more shade and they can get floppy, I think John cuts those two or three times. So now I think they did them in late May, again in June, and then he'll do another cut probably in mid-July. And they'll bloom later, but they'll also be beautiful, bushy, you know, just probably 12 to 18 inches tall, rather than the 30 or 36 inches that they would flop over if they were left to their own devices. So right. we do that a lot with plants. I think Nepeta's, some Monardas have been done occasionally.
I bet goldenrods. Do you do
Solidagos?
Yeah.
And some of the Coreopsis too, I think we hit. So
yeah, yeah. And so it's again, it gives you, without staking or anything like that, which would just be impossible, it gives you a kind of bushier plant, which is kind of great and needed. Otherwise, you can have a lot of floppy things, especially as you point out in the shady areas.
Right.
So you have a lot of that going on. And I imagine that you do some thinning also, because you have a lot of wind, don't you?
Oh my gosh, yes. In fact, it was quite windy this morning, and lovely wind because it was low humidity wind for a change. But
right.
I know that on some of the Joe Pye weeds, for instance, which can get rather dense and tall, those can be very affected. We do it also with Baptisias, the false indigos.
Sure.
So there are some of the larger flowering perennials that really need to be in the windier spots, do need to be kind of thinned out so they don't create too much sail. And of course we do that with all of our trees as well. We keep, all of the birch trees and the oaks and everything pretty well laced out to make sure that we're getting a lot of good dappled light on the understory, because we are known for having this complex tree canopy, flowering spring trees, you know, maybe the amelanchiers or the red buds, and then the ground cover layer. And all of that coexists. And that's what I think makes the Highline such a great place to visit, because the gardens are so intense and you have all those different layers, but it just takes a lot of management to make sure everything stays happy.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's a lot. Definitely a lot. But you were just talking about sort of pruning essentially the trees, and you know, the fact that what all of us confront, speaking of things that change in a garden, no matter whether we're managing it naturalistically or not, is usually less light, because our trees and shrubs grow, you know, as
right.
we're there for longer. And so sometimes there's the hard decision to even remove a woody plant sometimes, because it's at the, you know, it's surviving at the expense of, as you're pointing out, like the ground cover layer or whatever. There's just not the light that there was, and everything else is suffering. And that's a really tricky one. But again, that's no matter what your style of or your design aesthetic, that's one that gardeners face who stay put for a long time, you know, and
exactly.
And shrubs grow, right? I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
And it's not a light decision that we make to thin trees out. I think people were surprised how well trees actually did on the Highline. I don't think they expected them to get quite so tall and quite so full. So it's easier to say, you know, it's just getting too crowded in this space, the easiest thing to do, rather than try to manipulate every single tree into being just the right amount of open. We can selectively take out a tree here or there and open things up, and it looks more natural, frankly. You can think about getting that next succession, those younger trees growing in your woodland, so it feels a little bit more natural, and then you're planning for succession. Because if all the trees are 20 years old, all the trees are potentially going to fail at the same time. So now we're thinking about getting some smaller trees in this fall, so we have this different age level. And in areas like the flyover, which is the area people may be familiar with the elevated walkway, there we're frankly getting quite a bit of reseeding. The well, the sassafras come up everywhere, but the magnolias, the big leaf magnolias are self-seeding. Some of the sweet bay magnolias are also self-seeding. So we're leaving those and we get to select out. And that, and even in our bur oak grove, we have some seedlings that we're going to leave. So we'll have different ages. And so it just is creating that, thinking about what is going to be successful in 5 or 10 years is just planning ahead.
Yeah. We have a couple, you know, maybe 2 minutes left. And I just wanted to ask sort of an adjunct sort of to one of the things we were talking about before with kind of self-sowns, even ones that are specced in the plan, in the design, even ones that you love, like I think John, who you referred to before, John Gunderson, one of your senior gardeners, he has a lot of Virginia bluebells, Mertensia virginica in his area. And there can be too much of a good thing, right? It can self-sow too much and kind of distort the plant, the look, right? So sometimes you're taking also kind of edit out things that are desirable, but not in excess. Is that another sort of mandate?
Yes, exactly. The Mertensia is one of the situations where it's great where we have it and it looks so natural the way it kind of occurs in these big drifts that go across the pathway. But John does do some seed head chopping, and then of course it does need a cleanup in the spring because the leaves, as they kind of are fading back, don't look so great. Often Pete's really good about, if he's using ephemerals and bulbs and things like that, he'll have a plant that will be growing up to hide the leaves that are yellowing. He's quite good about that combination. Right. I know, for instance, we have quite a bit of casmanthium, the northern sea oats, and we've noticed that reseeds quite a bit. So we have to be, as much as we are the garden that you should come to see because we have these beautiful seeds in the winter, we do selectively reduce some of the seeds just so we don't end up with too many plants.
Exactly. And it's tough. And especially on newer gardeners, it's tough because, you know, no one wants to get rid of anything or compost anything or throw anything away, so to speak. And it's tough. It's a tough decision, but Well, the High Line, I'll give all the information along with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, you know, about visiting. And
yes,
I think your gardeners told me that best times to visit are between 7 and 9 a.m.
Huh? Oh, my gosh. We do get very crowded because we're very popular, and that's great. But if people really want to have an experience, come between 7 and 9 a.m. or even in the evenings. We're open in the evenings in the summertime. That's lovely. We're open till 10 p.m.
Wow.
Okay. And it's an interesting experience at night. All the plants are low lit, so you can experience but really the morning is when it's magic.
All right. Well, yeah. Richard Hayden, thank you for making time. I know you got to get down there to 18th Street and go figure out that planting layout before it gets away from you.
So Margaret, it's been such a pleasure. You take
care. Yes, me too. Bye-bye. And thanks to all the rest of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, and you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.